Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Chet Haas from the Developer Relations team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Studio team.
And today we have two guests. Never been on the show before. Very exciting. We could have a drum roll, except it would hurt. Go.
Hey, I'm Rod Graves from the Android UX team.
And I'm Glenn Murphy from the Android UX team.
Excellent. So we're talking about, let's talk about programming. Let's talk about,
sure.
Let's talk about.
Wait a minute. Am I the right?
Let's talk about Android design. So both of you have been on like different aspects of Android for a while now. Yeah. I think I first met you when you were on Mindy's team doing UX prototyping stuff. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I worked with Mindy and then ultimately, took on a bunch of the user experience engineers, prototypers who work on the new versions of features that we're making.
Okay.
But I've been with Android since Marshmallow, working on task management and split screen and all sorts of stuff like that.
So working with a lot of the system UI, sort of how we expose platformy stuff.
That's exactly right.
UI. Okay, cool. And Glenn, I don't even know why you're in the room.
Yeah, I don't know either. I've been with Android since Marshmallow as well. I think slightly less time than Rod. And I manage the team.
So, right. And you were managing the other team, right? You came over from the Chrome world?
Yeah, I used to, I was on Chrome from the very beginning. So Chrome was kind of my baby and worked on that for 10 years and did Chrome OS and then joined Android. So pretty exciting, working on operating systems and platforms all the way through.
It tends to like suck people in and not let them go. Right. Like how many projects can you work on where you get to work at the OS level? And so
Absolutely. It
doesn't attract the people who aren't interested at all and everybody else just hangs on like barnacles.
Actually, when I first started working on Chrome and platforms, I was like, why would I work on these things? Like I kind of want to be building the content and the apps. And then I sort of worked on Chrome by chance, like it was just happening. And it pulled me in. And
I mean, it's kind of impressive to be, a UX designer on Chrome where the whole point was to like take away the UI in a sense, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was like you looked at the old browsers and they just had like bars upon bars with all kinds of just stuff.
Yep.
And then Chrome's like, let's make it lean.
Yeah. I think, the browser market was pretty mature at that point and a lot of us worked on Firefox and other browsers beforehand and we kind of went in knowing what we needed to do. Like there was a lot of precedent. We looked at what was happening and we were like, let's go build the browser that we've always wanted with none of the features that we don't want.
So I imagine these design meetings where instead of deciding on the stuff you want to put in, you just decide on the stuff to take out?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We spent.
So I was like, are we building a mail tool? And you said.
We spent a long time debating just the tiniest things. Like should Chrome have like a add as wallpaper menu item in the context menu when you right-click on images? Should there be a mail button? And sort of our default was like, no.
Yeah.
Add things in when we all feel that we really need them so that we don't end up in a situation where we're just adding 1,000 different things to appease 1,000 different needs and ending up with a product that sort of satisfies no one.
the Homer car of browsers.
That's right.
How much of that was coming from... So, Google overall has had like a sparse design aesthetic from the beginning, right? Just you've got the search bar and you have, up to three buttons and that's all you get, right? So was there a push from Google mothership or was this just the people that were brought under the browser project brought that?
No, Chrome in the beginning was very sort of separate from Google.
Sounds familiar.
We walled ourselves off so that we could sort of really focus. And I think just the team, that vision for hyper simple browser didn't just come from me. It came from all of the leads, the PM and engineering leads as well. We all just wanted sort of this very minimal tool to do what we felt was really important. And so part of it was a reaction to software at the time. Like if you look back in sort of the mid-2000s, software was really bloated. There were like a lot of buttons. Everyone was like, oh, I dreamt up a new feature. Let's add a button for it. And I think we were all getting a bit tired of that. So, yeah.
Right. It was kind of the heyday too, or maybe coming down from the heyday of like plugins and rich client experiences like within the browser and everything was getting kind of thick and, I don't know, isolated from everything else?
Yeah. I mean, a bunch of us had worked on Firefox and working on the extension system. My project before Chrome was to build an extension for, several extensions for Firefox. And so we were part of that, like, let's go add buttons to things. And then...
And Firefox was in itself a reaction to Mozilla, right? Which it was also like, let's delete a bunch of stuff from Mozilla and start over with just a browser, right?
Yeah. If you look back through the chain of browsers before Firefox, there was like Internet Explorer, which was actually a more minimal browser compared to Netscape. And so there was this history of browsers sort of growing and growing and growing, and then a new browser entrant coming along and being like, actually, you know, I've brought it back to the basics. And I think one of the best things that we did on Chrome was sort of keep it that way, mm-hmm. not let it sort of bloat and grow yeah. again.
You can only go one direction, right?
That's right.
Like if you start at that place, it's not going
to
go well.
Yeah. It's we used to say it's like 100 times harder to remove something yeah. than it is to add something.
Yeah.
So let's be really, really cautious about adding things.
Right. Bundle how does this easy, map but, to Android?
Sorry.
How would you map this to Android? Do we have the same sort of design
we have
trade-offs there in terms of system UI of, hey, we can't add it because we can't remove it? Or how do you think about this in Android?
Yeah, it applies pretty directly to Android. Like if Chrome is kind of the platform that you use while you're on a desktop, you know, most of the time that you're on a desktop, 90% of the time you're in a browser, then Android is just sort of the platform you use when you're not at a desktop. And so it's a very similar set of constraints and challenges. And I think it is similarly hard for us. I think, some of the hardness is like Android actually has a whole bunch of stuff in it already. And so what do we do with that? Removing things is hard. But at the end of the day, we kind of want to build that sort of tool that you can just very easily hold in your head. Just if you sort of sat down with a pen and paper and just sketched out what Android was from a spaces perspective, like all the different places, we kind of want everyone to have the rough ability to be able to do that, and not like some other operating systems where, oh, there's this secret place over here, and if you use a 3-finger drag and this other thing, you end up in this space. We want it, like, I think you need to be able to internalize and think about the whole system, and I think that helps people a lot.
I think I used the Android Froyo for about 6 months before I realized I could long press on the home button to switch apps.
Yeah.
I think I didn't even realize it. I was complaining to someone else on System UI, hey, we can't even switch apps. And they're like, yeah, you can, just long press on the home button. I was like, oh, that was something I would not have sketched down
yeah.
if I had to sit and try to write down the UI.
So how do you address that? There's always a tension between like hide as much noise as possible, but sometimes you need functionality, but you also need discoverability. Right, so you kind of want features to be there for the power users, the people that are going to, you know, need this thing on an ongoing basis, but you don't want it to be in the way and have, you know, the non-power users clicking on the settings button.
Yeah, and you get bonus points if you can include the word gesture navigation in your answer.
Yeah, I mean, like a common way that I think a lot of designers think about this is that common things should be simple. They should be intuitive. They should have affordances. It should be
I'm going to stop you there and say, please define affordance. I've heard that used in so many design meetings, and it always seems like the buzzwords where I can't quite grasp what they're talking about. Yeah.
Well, I think the canonical example from Don Norman is the door handle. You know, the door handle shows you, at least in a well-designed, you know, door handle, how you engage with that object. What can it do? It opens, it can be turned, it swings, hopefully the direction you try to pull it.
Yeah.
And you know, for things like doors, the things that you're going in and out of these spaces, they need to kind of be no-brainers. For more powerful things, it's more like it needs to be possible. So that might mean that it's not quite as visible, or it doesn't, you know, scream at you when it's there. But it lets you do that thing that you want to do. Maybe you seek it out if you need it.
Do you have specific examples? So you named a couple of the apps that you'd worked on the platform, and I'm sure you've worked on tons since then. Like specific examples where either you decided to cut a feature because it was just going to get too noisy, or you put it in and because you found a way that you could expose that to the user in a natural way? Putting you on the spot here, sorry.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's been a controversial one, but you know, part of system UI design is really the art of making compromises for billions of users in a way that is you know, ultimately the right choice. It's come up before, but the split screen feature that we introduced, I think it was Android Nougat,
yep.
You know, it used to be, you know, you just long press overview button and boom, your app was in split screen. And that was it's not very visible. You had to be taught it or you had to learn it.
Or do it by accident.
I'm sorry.
Or do it by accident.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. You know, that's another form of discoverability. But, you know, that really kind of put that at your fingertips. It was very convenient to get into split screen. And later on, we decided, based on how we saw it being used and other things in the system and the desire to make things really approachable, that it was okay for it to kind of live inside of overview a little bit farther away from your fingertips, but still there. That wasn't an easy choice, but it felt like the right decision, you know, thinking about the system as a whole.
So was that driven by experiences of people like getting into this mode where they didn't mean to, or doing user testing? Like, and how much does user testing come into these decisions in general?
Comes in a lot. I think that we do a lot of user testing. I think we also...
None of them are harmed in the lab. I should point that out, right? Most of them are not harmed in the lab. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Pretty high success rate. Right. I'm not harming people in the lab.
Low mortality rate, right? Am I right?
That's right. Yeah. All right. Most people make it. We do a lot of user testing. I think that we also just have a long intuition about doing this stuff. I think one of the things that as a design industry, we sort of under-acknowledge is that sometimes these things are obvious when you think about them for a little while. We listen to all the feedback. We read all the forums, we listen to all the things. And sometimes that might provoke a question or a conversation about something. There might have been a space where, due to time constraints, we let something go or let something ship, some part of the system. And then we notice people start hitting that thing, the long press on the overview button is sort of people accidentally activating it. And that might get us to reconsider the way that we've used a space. But I think that a lot of these times a lot of it is just down to patterns that we've used before. There are only so many ways that you can have a user interact with a button. And so,
it seems like the point you made about intuition is good. Because I think if you just user test and tweak, you're going to optimize for local maximum.
Yep.
Where sometimes you want to do something dramatically different. And that's probably not going to come out of user testing. That might be sort of a designer that has some insight and try something brand new that turns out to work.
Yeah, I think this is a tricky one. Like, I think the ability to kind of close your eyes a little bit and role play through using the product yourself is kind of an important aspect of doing design. Sort of you can sit there, you do your design work, and then sort of take a breath, step back, and step through it as if it was new to you. It's a challenge. I think we all struggle with it, being too deep.
I mean, it seems almost impossible.
It's hard. Our user base is very diverse. We have a large set of different users, and it's not like any one of us can represent sort of the ideals of many.
I was more thinking of the case where a product you're familiar with, trying to approach it again as a beginner when you don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what I've observed some user studies of software I thought was perfect because I use it all the time.
Yeah.
And then you see a user, you're seeing it through a one-way mirror, and you're kind of shocked about certain things you thought were obvious are clearly not obvious.
Yep.
I don't think I could put myself in that situation to try to imagine that I don't understand this already because I'm kind of polluted.
I think you could. I think it's something where...
You believe in me. That's excellent.
I do. I have high confidence.
All right.
But I think it's one of those things where over time you sort of build up a set of questions to ask yourself. As you're evaluating something, you might intuitively, having worked on it for a while, think, oh yeah, I'll just press that button. But then over time, you build up this repertoire of questions such as like, how would I know to press that button? Upon reading that text, just by itself, would I understand exactly what it meant?
And so you're basically like unit UI testing it. You're sort of going through and just making sure that everything has a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, actually, I know we're on the ADB podcast. I think that some of the bits very similar to API design. You know, if you are building an API for other developers to use, you are building an interface, the UI, for other developers to use. And you are presenting them with a set of things that they can use to build a mental model in their head to use and deploy. And I think we've all used great APIs and we've all used terrible APIs. And I think it's a very similar challenge, like stepping through, oh, what is the picture that the user of my thing, whether that's an actual interface or an API, what is the picture that they're building up in their head as they're using it?
That seems difficult, though, in that, like, we're, designing and implementing a platform, which is huge, right? If you consider mm-hmm. the amount of surface area just covered by system UI or just covered by a launcher or just by, any specific app. And so, obviously, we have a lot of people working on the pieces. So then who has, and maybe the answer is, you or the people sort of directing the projects, who has the overview that allows them to see the whole picture as opposed to like, does my button make sense? Yeah, that button made sense, but actually what didn't make sense was the fact that it was in the context of this other thing that was really confusing next to it.
Yeah, I think that's where sort of being able to step back and evaluate the whole thing gets really important. And I think one thing that we also don't talk about a lot at Google and in sort of the industry is it's really important that we enjoy using our own product. You know, we just spent this time talking about sort of stepping back and sort of thinking through it through someone else's eyes. But at the end of the day, it's really important that you enjoy using the thing that you've built. And I think that's where sort of personal taste comes into it as well. Like if you are using a product that you're working on and you're not enjoying it, then that's kind of a pretty good signal. And I think it's an important signal, because I think if you don't love the product that you're building and you have this excuse of like, oh, I'm just building it for someone else who will love it, then you will never give it the care and attention that it truly deserves. You'll never have that internal motivation to make it great. And I think that's not just true of design. It's true of anything that we might build, apps, you name it. And I think that that's just something I want to emphasize, that it's really important that we enjoy the thing that we're building. And so we're always using Android as we're building it and talking to each other and sort of questioning. It's like, hey, this felt a bit weird. Can we like talk about this? Like what Rod and I do for half the day.
You mentioned, you know, starting in your head and trying to imagine what it would be like to use it. But we try to get out of our head pretty quickly and make something that we can actually, you know, kick around. We can try it. And if it feels exciting, that's great. If it doesn't, you maybe we do a little bit more thinking, but it has to kind of graduate into something that that shows promise in actual use with our team and then with more and more people.
Can I ask how you, I might use the word ideate here, except I hate that word, so I'm not going to. How do you develop ideas and play with them in a way that really gives you real world experience with how it's going to work? So, you know, are you drawing things on paper and sort of, you know, doing whiteboard things? Do you have a prototyping piece of software? Do you actually implement this stuff? I mean, I know a lot of the designers code as well. And so do you actually write the code that puts it in a sample app so you play with it?
It's kind of all of the above. It really depends what it is we're trying to prove out. Yeah. If it's, you know, does the UI make sense? Yeah, we kind of need a prototype to really understand how it's used in practice when you're developing muscle memory and stuff. But if it's, you know, is this ranking algorithm good? You know, it's a very different type of prototype and it may not even need an interface. And so we kind of, you know, tailor how we proceed based on the questions that we have in front of us.
I think one of the things that, you know, one of the things that keeps me excited and working on this stuff is a large part of what we do is identifying opportunity. So, you know, Rod just mentioned that a ranking algorithm change. And so sometimes when we're thinking about things, it's not just go off into a blank space or a room and sort of dream something up. It's often it is, oh my goodness, this part of the company has just built this piece of technology that enables something, you know, ranking of applications or voice recognition or something else. And this other part of the company has built this other piece of technology. Like there's this sort of bolt of lightning moment where we're like, wait, if we put those things together, you could get something kind of amazing. And I think that that's where, to bring it all the way back to Chrome as an example, because it's an easy example, we were like, oh, there's this WebKit thing, and that's going really well. There's this team in Denmark who we know could build a really fast JavaScript engine. There's this other team who has sandboxing technology, and we've got a whole set of people who've worked on browsers before. Oh, there are all these pieces that lined up. You know, we could put them together in an exciting way. And so I think that's where we actually spend a huge amount of time. The actual design components of, you know, the very specific UIs where it's like, oh, there's this screen and we need to show someone this piece of information and get them to press this button. That's an easier challenge for us. I think there are patterns in material and others that help us with that. Most of our time and debate comes from how can we fit these intersecting things together, given that sometimes they haven't been built yet, but we just know they're on the path to being built.
Often I think I feel like a switchboard operator where I'm kind of taking this plug and connecting it to that one and, you know, channeling that kind of connection between these different ideas and technologies as much as crafting an actual UI.
I wonder, so you were saying like, well, that's the easy part, you know, sort of skinning, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Although it depends on where the platform is at in its lifespan. I'm thinking skinning back in 1.0 or 1.2, probably not so easy, right? Because the pieces weren't really there to do it. Nothing was consistent. They hadn't really developed the patterns and the metaphors.
Yep.
Now it's kind of, it's solid. Like we know what an Android interface overall is going to be like, and then it's a lot more
I think over the past 10 years, 10 years ago, people didn't know what mobile software should look like.
Yeah.
And I think that there was a large period of discovery, you know, basic questions about, will people understand dragging with their fingers?
Yeah.
How will that all work? And I think
there's a pretty big pivot with material design as well, I think.
Yeah, super important. Yeah.
The way I think of material too is it was, well, Holo had started to go in that direction, but like it put down a system, right? Mm-hmm. There was like ideas behind everything. And so if you had a new design thing you needed to do, there was like a universe that you could plug it into, as opposed to like everything's just being made up on a case-by-case basis, right?
Yeah. Instead of spending all your time deciding, well, what should this button look like? Right. That type of thing.
Yeah. What kind of motion should we have here? Well, the curve is on the web page.
Yeah.
Okay. We think, you know, for me as a designer coming in Marshmallow, just after a lot of that material design work had happened, it was amazing. I'd never worked with a design system that let me solve what I kind of found were the really interesting or new problems, and not focus on kind of just the very typical kind of pattern following. How do I make the button I'm doing slightly better? But like, what is this for? Who is it for? How does this actually work or make someone's life better? That's really the kind of problem that I hope to spend most of my time on.
So I'm going to step back just because it occurred to me as we were talking, we talked about discoverability earlier, and I think sometime around the Lollipop release was when we started doing like tutorial screens. The first time you use your device, the first time you use the launcher, an app, whatever, there's like a really invasive blue thing that pops up and says, hey, I got some information to show you about the following thing. Like, is that still a pattern that we use? Like, how useful is that for actually, like, how much do you find people just trying to get that thing to go away versus does that actually provide the discoverability for the unobvious features?
Both. I think it's, we spend a lot of time debating things like that and how they should fit into the experience because, you know, there's a set of people for whom that is just noise. They're like, oh, I got my phone. I know how to use a phone. Please don't tell me how to use my phone. And then other people for whom that's their only introduction to how the way these things work. And so it is a continual balance. I think, you know, this happens across the industry. You think about like computer games and game tutorials. Sometimes you start a game and they're like, press W to walk forward. I know.
If there's a skip button or at least a quick way to swipe it away, it's okay. I think our photo scanner app, the companion app to Google Photos, has this intro. And as far as I can tell, you can't skip it. So every time I install it on a new phone and I want to scan, it's like, okay, prepare for the next 30 to 60 seconds to watch something. And
the implementer was really, really proud of that sequence of stills. Yep. Very happy about that.
I think that's kind of a must, I think, is to make sure that if you have it, make it easy to dismiss for people who've actually seen this app before on a different phone.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to scale, though. Like, how would you, you know, designing that for, say, someone who has been using a phone for 10 years and they've just bought sort of the new phone that has gesture nav and so on, teach them, like, for that person, you probably don't need to teach them how most of the phone works. You probably just need to teach them how some of the phone works. Whereas for someone else who may be getting a smartphone for the first time, you need to teach them the whole lot. And so how do you allow people to skip the right things but not miss the wrong things? Is it really, like, this is not an easy challenge, and it's something we spend a lot of time on trying to think through how exactly to surface those things.
One of the things we actually do as a team that I think helps keep us honest is that when we have new designers join, we often have them do an exercise of basically just running through Android as a new user. In many cases, you know, they have more or less experience. For people with less experience, seeing through their eyes, seeing how they perceive Android as a new user, what pain points they come across. Even though they're an expert, they're a designer, and that's why we hired them, it can be really, really illuminating for the rest of us who have become super fluent or accustomed to how Android works.
Yeah. So this is after you hire them. This is not the interview for joining the team?
Oh, maybe it should be. Yeah. No, it's after we hire them. I think the other part of it that's hard is we need to limit what we should do. We don't want to bombard people with too many pieces of information. Like if you give people 10 different instructions, they'll remember zero of them. If you give them one, they'll probably remember it. If you give them three, they'll probably remember it. And so a lot of it's about choosing which things to emphasize. And that's the really hard one.
Yeah. I mean, the question is whether you want to make it a tutorial for people about how the app works or if it's, you want to tell them what's new.
Yeah.
Right? Because at least expert users for complex software, you know, you want to let them know that there's this new capability they might have missed.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So in Android Studio, we have this what's new assistant that sits over on the right that we for each release show once.
Yep.
So you can just dismiss it if you don't care, but you can also read if you're interested in what it is we've added. I don't know if that applies to a very simple app, like a note-taking app. Maybe you don't need like, here's what's new in this version. But I feel like for something like the Gmail app or maybe Google Photos, right? Like that there could actually be significant things we've rolled out that you know, that it would be useful to learn about.
Here are the 57 developer options that we have in this yeah. release.
Well, I just know, I know lots of people who do not know that they can search their photos. I see them scrolling, scroll, tap, tap, you know, to try yep. to find that one photo. And I just like, hey, look, you can just type, search for the word tent if yep. you're looking for a camping photo and it'll find it.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that I think, you know, it would have maybe been useful to teach people.
Well, I think it brings up and you know, one of the patterns that we think about is just, what can we infer? What can we understand from how someone is using the product and how can we use that to help them accomplish what it seems like they might be trying to accomplish? So if we see
sounds like know, clipping.
Endless
looks
scrolling,
like you're trying you're to looking, find a photo. You
know, well, that's that is definitely the, you know, the
has that
the
like
flashpoint
ruined,
example.
Has that ruined assistance for all software? It always becomes a joke. The second you try to suggest some sort of like detection of user activity with a helpful thing, it's like, oh, Clippy.
Yep.
Like, is
well,
it?
I think it's one of those things where, you know, you do it wrong and it's so painful and it feels so bad.
Yeah.
But when it works, you don't even remember it, right? There's kind of a like a bias there of the things where he's like, you discovered it in the context of doing it. You think, oh, well, I just, you know, it just worked well. I just knew how to do
yeah.
it. You forget how you learned it sometimes.
I mean, I often get that in search. I'll search for something and then it'll actually offer some really, really good result based on some other activity. And it's always kind of amazing to me.
Yeah.
So the new features reminds me. So I bought a lot of keyboards, music keyboards over the years. And the thing that always amused me on them is all of them have a demo button and it's only there for the store, right? They want this thing to seem really amazing in the store. And so they add something that I, as a user of this piano, never want, right? I'm not going to play demo mode in my house. That is not why I bought the damn thing.
My 6-year-old would disagree
like
with
pretend,
you.
You know, yeah, yeah. It's the kid okay. mode. Look what I can all do. Right.
Maybe that's it. But it seems like you're asking for demo mode for apps, right? Like, take me into the mode that shows me the things that I want to know about this, as opposed to like every time I launch it for the first time, it's going to go, hey, what about this thing? What about this
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, but the thing, because I've also bought keyboards for that, right? That's really just meant to show you what it can do, but not how to do it.
Yeah.
This is really like, if yeah. they said, hey, there's a hidden mode in this somewhere, that sounds like the Tesla Easter egg, yeah. you know, like, yeah. hey, we have this Easter egg, the new version, to see if you can find it. It's not like that. It's saying, hey, we have this functionality, you should beware. It'll make right. you a happier user. Letting them know about that seems useful because, you know, we know, even in Android Studio, lots of users don't use some of the most useful functionality.
I think the other challenge is like, who determines what is useful to the user? I think yeah. we've all sort of been the recipients of like, well,
I would say that's a question for the UX people. Do we know any UX people we can ask?
I don't know.
We should have them on the show sometime. So, yeah. So as you were talking about this, as we were talking about like the discoverability, remember a few years ago when if you got something that was a really complicated gadget, mm-hmm. Like say, I don't know, a DVD player, mm-hmm. you would kind of read the manual. Like
what?
You would. There was a day when you kind of at least glanced at the manual because this stuff was not obvious. And so you would look at this piece of paper. And we get these amazingly complicated computers that we just paid a whole lot of money for, and nobody's ever thought about reading a manual. I think some of the old phones that I got on the team years and years ago, there would be a manual somewhere in the box, yep. but I think we've completely given up on that, right?
I think we still have them, but as you—
Maybe a legal requirement or something.
Yeah, no, like, I think I actually did the unboxing a year ago. It's a very, very small booklet. It doesn't have all the information, but it basically tells you where to get it.
Here's the power button.
There's an online feature guide that tells you everything.
That's like the most thankless task for a tech writer ever is to write a manual for a device that nobody ever wants to read the manual for.
People will find it. I mean, recently we moved buildings and we had these desks now. And I, you know, if you want to sort of raise the desk, you have to stand there and hold the finger on the button until it's all the way there. And I thought, that can't be right. So I Googled it and I found the instruction manual for the table and discover the special codes to insert to reprogram the mode where it goes.
That's exactly my point, actually, is what is different about our space in that nobody's ever going to look up the information on how System UI works on an Android phone, this incredibly complicated thing.
I have tried
for gadgets in our life, even as something as simple as an electronic table, we'll go and find the manual.
I have actually tried to figure out how gesture navigation works.
With a manual.
I tried to search online, right? I did not.
Stack Overflow does not qualify as
a... There are some instructions. You know, if you actually go to settings and turns it on, there are some instructions, but they're not complete. I just discovered the other day, you can switch apps really quickly by just swiping the little bar on the bottom. I don't think they mentioned that. So I figured there must be more tricks.
I think it's really interesting to see how YouTube has really emerged as such a repository of like the expert knowledge of, you know, people who have found these things, they share it. And really, like, for anything that I've had to do as a new homeowner, go to YouTube.
And then suffer through about 2 minutes. Hey, what's up? This is my guy.
You got to skip the first minute. Yeah.
So it's not RTFM, it's WTFY. Yeah. Okay.
I think what we're sort of talking about is like, what should be the correct visibility for education? I think this sort of goes back to this challenge that we have about, there's only very limited screen real estate and time and attention. And we need to fit what we can into those moments. So there are plenty of people, I would say a large part of the Android user base, who don't actually need to know different parts about the way different things work. And so by telling them about it, we're just sort of taking it away from their experience elsewhere. It's giving them information they don't necessarily need. And I think that's the struggle that we have. And sometimes we correct for that. Sometimes we're like, oh, people don't need to know about this. And it turns out it's super popular. And we're like, of the people who do know about it. And we're like, oh, maybe if we elevated the visibility of this, that would be better for everyone. And I think that's actually a pretty reasonable product development approach, which is, if you're dealing with 1,000 potential features and you don't know exactly which ones sort of deserve to be surfaced and which ones don't, you can start by not necessarily surfacing them highly. There will be the people who will read the manual and will find the thing and tell other people about it. And those will tend to be the types of things that you may want to elevate more, which I think is a better sort of, let those things evolve into existence rather than let's just make 1,000 things visible up front.
It's the Cornell sidewalks. I think it's Cornell, isn't it? Like they don't build in all the sidewalks they think they need. Mm. Instead, they see where the paths develop and put the sidewalks there.
Yeah. Right?
So see what the paths are that the users are building. But then how do you find that information, right? How do we know what's happening out there in the real world, right? Are we looking in the right places to find out the things that users are excited about?
Yeah. This is where user research and studies and other things come in as well. And I think that's sort of the exciting part. Sometimes you discover something that people are using your product in a way that you hadn't expected. You know, one example would be the original overview button in Android, the square. There was a lot of debate over just at Google and the company. It's like, what is that really necessary? Do people really need to task switch like that? And it turned out that there were some phones where it was an incredibly popular feature amongst Nexus users. It was like, there were people who were using it 50 or more times a day. And then there were other phones in the ecosystem, exact same UI, but just sold differently, where usage was like negligible. It's like 2-3%. And so that's just a really interesting thing. Different people who buy different phones use the products in different ways. And so
maybe the button was just really hard to push on those other phones.
Yeah, maybe.
So speaking of exciting features, is there anything that you worked on? So we just, the latest release, 10, came out recently, right? And I think just this week we announced Pixel 4. So we've got, you know, hardware that plus other hardware out there showing this release. What excites you in the UI? Stuff that you worked on or just stuff in the UI that we are now
you wish you'd worked on?
I'm a manager, I didn't work.
Or things that you're still thinking about, whatever.
Yeah.
I think it's really exciting to start to see more and more of this, you know, AI-powered accessibility that we're seeing. Things like live transcribe, any audio on the phone, all of a sudden you get closed captions. It's amazing. It's kind of a capability that, you know, didn't exist that now you have.
The Recorder app is fantastic.
It's another great example.
It's so good.
Yeah.
I hope it teaches more people to start reading again.
What?
I think we've just become
a society
of people that just watch now. So maybe, you know, if we put words in front of their face, they'll start reading again. I miss when people read books.
I'm pretty excited about the work that we did to get the face authentication working on the new Pixel 4, make it feel good. We came from a world of fingerprint sensors, which were sort of a very easy to activate thing on the back of the phone. And so we have this new technology that can read your face. How should we make it work? And I think to sort of go into some of the details, one of the things that we spent a lot of time discussing and sort of was should we wait at the lock screen once we've authenticated your face, or should we just go straight into the phone? And I think that you know, other phones in the ecosystem in mobile will often just wait at the lock screen. You'll sort of pick up the phone, turn it on, and it'll just wait there, and it'll say, please swipe to go into the phone. And for us, we, you know, on one side, we were like, okay, it's nice to have the lock screen there. You can see your notifications and so on. But on the flip side, shouldn't computing just be transparent. Shouldn't you just pick up your phone and start using it where you left off? And I think we landed in a pretty good space. And I think it was a good example of sort of a design discussion and direction that sort of evolved over time as we tested out different paths and came to a conclusion. So it's kind of nice. I can pull out my phone and just there. I can be writing an email, put my phone in my pocket, pull it back out again, be back writing the email as quickly as possible. So I'm pretty proud of all the work the team did to get us there.
So if you want to see the notifications on the lock screen, you have to kind of sneak up on it then?
No, you just pull down from the top. Same as if you're using the phone.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Or maybe just cover one eye.
Yes. You could do that too.
You can't send text behind your body, you know, yeah, in a meeting.
But you know, it's a good question. Like it is one of, like, when we first started down this path, that was one of the key questions that we had. It was like, oh, but that case, if I want to check, how am I going to do that thing? Yeah. And so we spent time thinking through, you know, what it meant, and we're weighing up sort of this existing behavior of checking stuff on the lock screen versus where we thought computing should just go, which is lock screens should just disappear as a concept. You just sort of pull out your phone and be doing what you were doing. But it led to things like showing you the notification. Sort of, if your phone buzzes and you pull your phone out of the pocket, it will heads up display the notification that you just got. So you still get that experience of feeling the buzz, pulling your phone out, and being able to interact with that thing. So
yeah,
we think we made the right trade-offs, and I'm pretty happy using it.
So for changing the experience of that, a lot of these things come up where we decide to change a fundamental interaction piece on the device. And internally, I've heard people refer to it as moving their cheese.
Yep.
Right? Like, this is the thing that I always did. This is where I found it. This is how I interacted with it, whether it's, you know, the placement of the menu button way back in the day, or, you know, the way the icons look, or whatever it is. Every change that we make is gonna upset somebody. So then how do you weigh that absolutely known possibility of upsetting people with the possibility that it's going to be, in the long run, a better experience for
Example, moving the time, right? That was controversial.
You mean when we made the hour bold and then unbold?
No, when we moved it to the left side from the right side. Or wasn't there some,
imagining this?
Yeah,
Was notch related.
Okay.
Right, yeah. Because the notch was going to make it too small a space on the right, and so something had to give, right?
That's right. This challenge is it's a huge one, and I think it's one of those trade-offs that we kind of have to make. I think there are a set of questions we ask ourselves to sort of get ourselves over the hump of some of these questions. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, we would ask, like, okay, if it was the other way around, like, let's say the clock was always on sort of the left-hand side and we decided to move it to the right-hand side, is that a change that we would make? Or to help us feel, to get rid of that sort of historical bias, like, is this really the right thing for us to do? Or is this just us inventing a different way of doing the same thing just for the sake of changing stuff? And I think that you're right, that we do kind of want to just build the right product. We ask ourselves the question of, like, if we were designing this phone from scratch today, is this what we would do? And I think it's really important to sort of hold that in our heads, because mobile is not done yet. We've still got a long way to go. And I think we need to get into the state of being able to evolve to that endpoint, because otherwise, you know, we'll be stuck using the same thing forever and ever. And the way we go about it is something that we decide on a per-feature basis. So gesture nav, as an example, is something that you get by default out of the box when you get a new phone. But if you just take the update on your existing phone, you remain in button nav. And then you can enable gesture nav as a new option.
Yep.
So it's not like overnight, like suddenly everything has changed.
Yeah.
But there are other things where maintaining two things at the same time is kind of weird. Like the clock, we wouldn't really have a setting to choose which side the clock goes on. And so sometimes we just have to sort of pull the Band-Aid off and do it.
Yeah.
And it's something that keeps us up at night because it's hard. You don't want this tool, this thing that's at the center of your life. You know, you do so much stuff on your phone. You don't want it to just be constantly changing in ways that you don't like or expect. But at the same time, you want it to get better.
Yeah.
And that's a really hard trade-off. No anything to add, Rod, but... You do this a lot.
I think the example of how do you change the default, and, you know, choosing the right moment. It's not just about how much pain do you have to get through to get to the value, the better experience that exists once you've done that. But what is the context that that's happening in? Is it happening while you're in traffic, well, that's probably the worst time, right? That makes, even if it was really valuable, the pain is so out of proportion. So we really need to use judgment when it comes to changing how these devices that we use every day.
And I can imagine this is a good example where some users are going to be very happy and some are not, a bit mm-hmm. like your resets button, right? Is that yep. this is probably going to test differently on different populations.
Absolutely.
And then at what point do you decide to put in a setting? Like, sure, we changed this thing, but here's a setting. And I think we used to do that much more generously in the yeah. old days. It was kind of an infinite space that you could dump switches into.
Yep.
I don't think we do it as much anymore, right? I know yeah. gesture nav is one of those things because yep. that was a really big change and you want to, especially since we're not auto-opting everybody in.
Yeah.
But...
How do you decide?
How do you decide yeah. whether to allow there to be a setting on this decision that you've made?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to how painful it really is across how many users.
Yeah,
I think settings are a contentious and really difficult topic. I think in theory, we would all love an infinitely configurable operating system. In practice, I think you get... several challenges with that. One is the people who accidentally flip the wrong settings. You know, I think a lot of people go through settings. And it's one of the first things they do when they get a phone. They're like, they pull out settings and they're like, oh, what can I do with this? And then that sounds cool, turn that on. And then they end up in a super weird state. And so we want to avoid having too many of those situations. And I think the other part is just internally for us as a team, is it better to put all our effort into making one thing awesome or spread that effort across two things or three things yeah. and make them all like, well, kind of okay. And, you know, and then you end up with a phone where everyone is in a slightly different state, becomes really hard to test, more bugs appear. It's a quality thing. But I think it's something we struggle with. Like, I think as designers and I think as engineers, we all love the idea of like an editable world, like having control over things. And so not providing that control is also a painful thing.
It also seems like maybe those settings are not actually there for users. They're there for the developers and the designers so that you can feel better. Well, you know, we made this really important decision, but well, if somebody doesn't like it, then at least there's a setting. Nobody's going to use it, right? Nobody's going to find that. It's not very discoverable. But you know that there's basically a plan B
yep.
in the platform.
That's right. I mean, sometimes there are settings. I think there are many things in developer settings that...
which we really don't want people to find in general.
Yeah, we don't want them to find it, but obviously as developers of the product, we find super useful. And yes. we really want, like there are several things in there that I use. There are sometimes things we put in there that help us test the next version of the product.
Yep. So.
I think it also goes to, you know, what's really the best use of someone's time and energy. And, you know, you can only learn so much. You can only spend so much effort, you know, working and changing this product that's in front of you. So how do we make sure that's the most valuable effort and time? How do you learn how to use something in the way that is most useful to you, as opposed to, you know, tweaking the tiny knobs? How do you make bigger decisions about this product?
How do you go about deciding if something should be configurable? So for example, I'm very happy that Android lets me pick 24-hour time. Yeah. I could totally see someone making the case that, well, that's kind of a niche. We should just probably pick whatever is the locale default. Right. So I assume in that case, maybe they thought, okay, there's a certain percentage of users, fine, so we're going to do it, right?
Yep.
But is that how you do it? Is it based on how many, what portion of our users? Is it number-based? Is it principle-based?
There is no very clear rules. I think to use the 24-hour time example, represent.
Okay, all right.
It's like that is something that you as a user have an expectation of outside of the phone. Yep. And so for the phone to not meet this expectation that you have as part of your overall life, if you have a house that are full of clocks at 24-hour time, okay. and you've got this one device that doesn't...
I could show that Glenn is doing thumbs up for all
this. I love 24-hour time, yep. having lived in Australia and dealing with time zones. You know, that's where the phone has to fit in with the rest of your life. But then there are other settings that only apply to the phone or only on the phone, and so they're less,
yeah.
Less necessary. I think... sometimes it comes down to like how strongly we believe that this other, you know, the new thing is the right thing. Like there are some things where if given the choice, people will be like, I don't want to learn the new thing, it's too hard. But if we strongly believe it's the right place to be, you know, there is that bit of a nudge, like, no, this is how it should work. And it's hard. You know, we will never get it absolutely 100% perfect for everyone in the world.
That's why there's always another release.
Yeah, always next time.
And
that'll be perfect.
Yeah, one setting I struggled with was the squeeze for assistant. I kept tweaking that thing too much to the, I can never get it right.
Yeah, I think I ended up disabling mine. Am I allowed to say that? I'm going to say that.
Say that.
Because I think everybody uses their phone differently. And if you find that you are mistakenly getting into a situation enough, you're just going to disable that feature, right?
Yeah, that's a good example of like, you know, some people hold their phones in very different ways.
Like, I can totally see the thinking behind, hey, people have different hand strength. Like we can't pick a default.
Yep.
On the other hand, you know, sometimes, you know, the reason I turned it off eventually was that it kept triggering when I would have it in my, like it would basically turn on the assistant as I was running or something. And so, and then of course it would pause audio and it was just super annoying to me.
Yep.
But I couldn't find the right setting that was just like, you know, I tried having it really high, but then it was like so high that I almost couldn't trigger it without, you know, getting white knuckles.
Yep.
So,
but that's a very common time fast headset. Like I think ideally we would have delivered something that just works 100% of the time for everyone, but there are always these special cases, you know, people who use, you know, car docks in certain ways and others. And so sometimes we're like, okay, well, if there are sort of these common and valid use cases in which case something breaks, then, you know, that's...
But I guess now with Soli, it's going to be like Blink for assistant or something, right? It's just going to look at you and you have to... No? No one's saying anything. All right. I think I just revealed an Android R feature.
Maybe.
But I mean, going back to your example of the squeeze for assistant, I think about, you know, is this setting just to make it different? Is it just a preference thing? Is it a setting to prevent some harm? Is it a setting to opt into something, to opt out of something? Because there's very different types of settings, and the choices we make, I think, often go to the benefit being different.
Okay,
kind of trailed off there, but it's really hard.
Yeah,
I was just thinking
that's why you guys get paid the big bucks.
The assistant that triggers when you're grabbing it too hard or differently is—it's not Clippy, it's Grippy.
Oh, that's cool. That now. Oh, why didn't we call it that? You want to join the team?
Yeah. I will be your copywriter. Yes. Yeah. All right.
This stuff is hard. It's fun though. I think sort of the discussions that you have about these things, they get into things about human behavior. I think that a different way to describe UX and what we do is user experience is kind of like applied courtesy. You know, when you're hosting someone at your house, you are often like, well, here's the Wi-Fi password. You know, you give them one instruction, you know, there is the bathroom. You're not like, oh, there's a bathroom and there are the forks and there are the plates and then there's the plumbing. You know, you think through what their experience is going to be like, and that's you being courteous. And I think that user experience is very much the same way. It's like that planning ahead of time so that people can feel comfortable when they're using your thing. And so these debates and discussions that we have are hard. They're kind of fun and happy in the same way, because at the end of the day, you're trying to deliver like joy to people in the best possible way. And sometimes you have to make some interesting trade-offs. But yeah.
It's a good note to end on, I think.
Oh, well, I guess.
I think it was just like a perfect role, perfect thing. Because, you know, we are coming up on the hour.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I was going to say, like your earlier point about building a mental model, the interesting thing to me is it's such a complicated experience that we're building a model for, right? The number of things that you can do just on Launcher, just in system UI, and then you bring in every app in the world, all of which have a different UI and a different pattern, different approach, and then they change it in their update. And like users are constantly bombarded with an infinite amount of ways of doing things. So then the trick, I would assume, for your teams is figuring out how to simplify this incredibly complicated world so that they can have sort of common basis for how to perform actions on this thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things we think about as well is what are cases where, you know, the phone is something that you use more and more throughout your life. And so there are probably more and more sort of regular, sort of non-tech nerdy people are becoming power users because they have to use this product day to day. And so historically, I think in software, there was like, well, there are the features for sort of regular people who will never figure the things out. And then there are features for the people who are really using Linux and like will read the manual and all that stuff. And I think now we're seeing a bigger blurring of those lines. You have sort of the very technical people who are like, I just want my phone to be the simple thing that makes phone calls so I can go focus on like writing stuff in Android Studio. And then that you have other people who are like Snapchatting insane amount of time a day, and they will eke out every last optimization that they can find in their system to make it work the way that they want. And I think that's a really interesting change that we've seen in the industry.
12-year-olds are basically the new power users, I believe. All right. Cool. Did we forget to ask anything? Did you forget to tell us anything?
Nope.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.